In the last century, the reduction of the world to numbers has only accelerated, especially in the computer age. Music is a prime example. While musical notation had set the stage long before, the mathematization of music intensified with Bach, because of whom, quote, the individual voice lost its independence and tone was no longer understood as sung, but as a mechanical conception. Bach, treating music as a sort of math, moved it out of the stage of vocal polyphony to that of instrumental harmony, based always on a single autonomous tone fixed by instruments, instead of somewhat variable with human voices, close quote. Today, with the digitization of music, its transformation into just so many bits of data is complete. Music is, like any other digital content, nothing but a series of numbers. Here's a good example of the reduction that quantification entails. Contrary to popular belief, the standard CD audio format is discernibly different from analog, particularly at the higher frequencies. Some of the original richness is gone forever. Music connoisseurs sometimes speak of the warmth of vinyl as compared to the coldness of digital sound. The technological solution, of course, is to increase the sampling rate to the point where the lost data is below human powers of auditory discernment. The infinite will still have been made finite, the continuous made discrete, but at least it is hoped this semblance of reality will be good enough. Digitization is applied to images as well, and potentially to anything capable of analysis. The motions of the human body, for example, can be converted into a set of numerical coordinates in a three-dimensional space. The sounds of human speech to just so many sine waves. The supposedly inherent reducibility. And note the naturalness of the word reducibility, of the world into numbers, and the assumption that either nothing significant is lost, or that we'll never notice what is lost, provided enough numbers are used, motivates the ultimate technological separation of humans from reality called virtual reality, VR. VR is the penultimate step in the substitution of manufactured reality for natural reality. With VR, the separate human realm will be complete except for one final step. If, as science implies, the entire universe is reducible to numbers, then we too are so reducible. Hence, the science fiction scenarios of one day achieving immortality by uploading our consciousness onto a computer where we could enjoy the best, most pleasurable of artificial experiences forever. The technological program of complete control over the world we experience would be fulfilled, or so goes the fantasy. Science fiction writers such as Neal Stephenson and Werner Vinge have described futures in which people live almost entirely in digital representations of reality or in wholly constructed realities. Such scenarios are already taking shape in the individual RFID labeling of all products sold, setting the stage for the internet to become nothing less than a virtual copy of the entire planet. Limiting direct access to something like 10 billion web pages or specific computers. In contrast, IPv6 will use 128 bits. This will allow the virtual tagging of every cubic centimeter of the Earth's surface from sea level to mountaintop, spreading a multidimensional data overlay across the planet. Every tagged or man-made object may participate, from your wristwatch to a nearby lamppost, vending machine, or trash can, even most of the discarded contents of the trash can, close quote. As presaged by naming a number, the potential exists for us to attempt the conversion of every object and person in the world into a data set. Whether in the digitization of music or the quantization of reality implicit in VR, the insanity of our ferocious strivings to manufacture a reality almost as good as the real thing should be plain. We are exerting tremendous effort to make an inferior version of a freely available original. similar to our fevered attempt to recreate the original affluence, in which work was not yet a concept, through ever more efficient labor-saving devices. That manufactured reality is inferior is demonstrated by the increasing intensity of our simulations, which seek to compensate for the lost richness and intensity of unmediated experience. No matter how large a set of numbers we produce to describe reality, something of its infinitude is lost. Instead, we must settle for close enough the lesser lives we live in the age of separation. The systems of representation, number, language, image, and so forth, we interpose between ourselves and reality are always a reduction of what they purport to represent. The scientific program of a complete mathematization of the universe is yet another Tower of Babel, aiming to attain the infinite by finite means. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. Ultimate and perhaps most significant conversion of reality into numbers is the measurement of time. Clocks do to time what name and number do to the material world. They reduce it, make it finite. And what is time but life itself? Time is experience, process, the flow of being. By measuring time, by converting it into numbers, we rob it of its infinitude and uniqueness in precisely the same way that nouns and numbers reduce the physical world. Time measurement turns a succession of unique moments into just so many seconds, minutes, and hours, and denies the particularity of each person's subjective experience of them. The keeping of time began in Neolithic times with the calendar, used to manage the planting of crops. Since calendars are based on the natural cycles of sun, moon, and seasons, their distancing effect is minimal, just as early agriculturalists were still tightly wedded to nature. Because the measure of time was cyclical and not linear, early calendars did not have the effect of binding time, creating history, and numbering the years of one's life. Soon, however, with the rise of long-distance commerce and hierarchical government, it became necessary to keep records over a span of years. In Egypt, Mesopotamia, India, China, and Central America, people began to number the years, e.g., from the start of a dynasty, thereby introducing linearity to time and divorcing it from the cycles of nature. The artificial division of the day into hours. Curiously, both the Babylonians and the ancient Chinese used 12, and the Hebrew invention of the seven-day week only deepened this divorce, which has culminated in the replacement of circular clocks with digital clocks, obliterating the last remaining link between measured time and the cyclical processes of nature. Crude division of the day into hours was sufficient for the demands of the Iron Age, but industry requires far more precise coordination of human activity. The development of mechanical clocks in the late Middle Ages set the stage for the Industrial Revolution. As Lewis Mumford put it, the clock, not the steam engine, is the key machine of the Industrial Age. The more finely we divided and measured time, first into hours, then minutes and seconds, the less we seemed to have of it, and the more the clock encroached upon and usurped sovereignty over life, until today we are all on the clock. To be punctual is the onus of a slave toward a master, or a subject toward a king. Today we are all subject to schedules imposed by the machine requirements of precision, regularity, and standardization. We think of machines as our servants, but our constant rush to be on time says otherwise. Immersed in linear time measurement, it is hard to appreciate the audacity of dividing up the day into standard units, man-made hours, minutes, and seconds that are deliberately unconnected to natural processes and therefore objective. The idea, to paraphrase Thomas Pynchon, that every second is of equal length and irrevocable is only as recent as the clock. Or as Paul Campos puts it, until very recently, there was no such thing as 6:17 a.m. The clock translates heavenly movement into earthly routine. Time measurement profoundly accelerated human separation from nature. Mumford comments, quote, "By its essential nature, the clock dissociated time from human events and helped create the belief in an independent world of mathematically measurable sequences, the special world of science. There is relatively little foundation for this belief in common human experience. Throughout the year, the days are of uneven duration, and not merely does the relation between day and night steadily change, but a slight journey from east to west alters astronomical time by a certain number of minutes. In terms of the human organism itself, mechanical time is even more foreign. While human life has regularities of its own, the beat of the pulse, the breathing of the lungs, these change from hour to hour with mood and action. And in the longer span of days, time is measured not by the calendar, but by the events that occupy it. In effect, clocks turn time into another standardized, interchangeable part of the world machine, facilitating the engineering of the world. Only time thus devalued is a conceivable object of commerce. Otherwise, who would sell their moments, each infinitely precious, for a wage? Who would reduce time, i.e. life, to mere money? Leibniz's merciless phrase, time is money, encapsulates a profound reduction of the world and enslavement of the spirit. It's not surprising that the revolutionaries of Paris's 1830 July Revolution went around the city smashing its clocks. The fundamental purpose of clocks is not to measure time, it is to coordinate human activity. Aside from that, it is a fiction, a pretense. As Thoreau said, time measures nothing but itself. Smashing the clocks represents a refusal to sell one's time, a refusal to schedule one's life or to bring it into conformity with the needs of a specialized mass society. Further, it represents a declaration that, I will live my own life, establishing the ascendancy of now. The scheduled and hurried life is the life of a slave whose life is not his own. A fundamental power over another is to compel them to appear when beckoned. When I say come, you will come. To rule a person's time is to rule his life. In modern society, we are chronically busy, too busy to do the things we want to do, too busy to stop and smell the roses, too busy to spend an hour looking at clouds, too busy to play games with children, too busy to spend more time on anything than is necessary. As John Surzan so poignantly observes, the clock makes time scarce and life short. Hence the compulsive obsession with speed, efficiency, and convenience in modern technological society. Why else would we seek to get there faster, do it faster, have it faster, except for the belief that our days are numbered? The anxiety of modern society comes in large part from the feeling that there is not enough time. You've always got to be doing something useful. You have to account for every minute of the day in a productive way. If, when you're going to sleep at night, you can't really say that you have used every minute of your time productively, then a piece of your life has flitted by, never to return again. You've just squandered it. Close quote. After all, any moment could be used to exercise more control over the world, to enhance survival and comfort. Maybe, after we have maximized the possibility of all these things, then we can afford some leisure, play, recreation. Afford? That is a financial metaphor, is it not? Time is money. To be at leisure originally meant not to be subject to the constraints of time. Today, we schedule in leisure, along with everything else, and the freedom to linger at whim by the roadside until good and ready to leave seems a rare luxury. Our leisure is more akin to a prisoner's furlough. We have lost the primal right to our own time. The pace of modern life continues to accelerate. In business, we have just-in-time inventory management, instantaneous communications, same-day turnaround. We schedule our days more and more tightly, down to the minute, even as we extend the regime of our schedule further and further into childhood, starting with the imposition of hospital schedules on the newborn. Time management and multitasking have become essential skills in coping with the onrushing deluge of modern life. They are, along with devices such as cell phones and personal digital assistants, technological fixes that apply yet more control to deal with the problems caused by control. Even as adult life marches to the ever-accelerating beat of the machine, so have the endless afternoons of childhood given way to the scheduled confines of school and other programmed activities. For the first time in history, children are too busy to play. Consider the tragedy of that statement. Let it reverberate in your chest. Children are too busy to play. The reason comes down again to survival anxiety. Play is a luxury, a frivolity, relegated to the cracks within the schedule of productive, educational, and developmental activities. The competitive demands of adulthood today dictate that no time be wasted in play, because every moment at play is a moment where your child could be getting ahead in life, preparing for the future. After all, play in adulthood is limited to our time off, and childhood is preparation for adulthood, is it not? So we seek to instill good study habits and a strong work ethic in our children. A sense of responsibility, lest they learn to put play, pleasure, and joy first. What kind of adult would they become then? Probably an undisciplined adult who cannot hold a 9-to-5 job and has little patience with boring, demeaning, or unpleasant work, the kind of work most of the population accepts as a grim necessity. So school comes first, then homework, then piano practice, then little league soccer, and then, if there is any time left, they can play. Several years ago, I noticed that when I raised my voice at my children, it was usually because of time pressure. Perhaps we had to be somewhere at a certain time, and they were not cooperating. More often, rather than a specific scheduled obligation, it was a non-specific feeling of anxiety, of time being short, of needing to move on to the next thing. Time scarcity becomes a habit of thought, a way of being. To force spontaneous, uninhibited little children to conform to adult schedules requires just that, force. My children resisted scheduling. Whatever they wanted to do it now, and for as long as it took. If we were never in a hurry, we would never lose our patience. Today, as I integrate the insights of this book into my own life and loosen the hold of time, I find I rarely yell at my children or lose my patience with them, not because I've become a saintly person, but because there is no reason to. Let them take as long as they want. Okay, Matthew, go ahead and play with your socks for half an hour instead of putting them on. Why would I not let a little boy play with his socks? Only if we were running late, as we chronically are in modern society. Always, the next obligation hangs over our head, keeping us from full devotion to what we are doing. The constant interruption in the natural rhythm of children's play, which must steal whatever moments it can from the cracks in the adult-imposed schedule, trains us for an adulthood of furtive, hurried pleasures. As alluded to in the opening chapter, the endemic busyness of modern life is one of its defining features, and certainly not a temporary aberration to be abolished with the next generation of futuristic labor-saving devices. To be busy is to be unfree. It is to have one's time constrained. It is to be subject to the priorities of necessity. It is the natural result of a childhood acculturation that yokes our lives to the omnipresent threat of deprivation, of affection, approval, or even physical comfort. We are, by adulthood, deeply conditioned against play. When we say we are too busy, what do we mean? We mean that we have to do other things, priorities dictated by survival. We mean we are not at liberty to do what we want to. It would just not be practical, we believe, to put play before work. We envision losing our jobs, going bankrupt, ending up on the street. That play could actually be productive without consciously directing it at productivity rarely occurs to us, and when it does, we assign it to the province of those lucky few, artists and geniuses, who get to do what they love. But actually, the logic is backwards. Genius is the result of doing what you love, not a prerequisite for it. The problem, of course, is discovering what that is. That is what childhood is supposed to be for, but our culture has turned it into the opposite. When we are so thoroughly broken that we know not what we love, the only way out is to first stop doing what we do not love, to do nothing for a while. This is the message encoded in the biblical story of Exodus, in which the children of Israel, after fleeing slavery, had to wander the desert for 40 years before they found the land of milk and honey. Similarly, we must overthrow the dictatorship of busyness and allow ourselves to wander for a while in order to discover our bliss. The deepest irony of all, and the gravest indication of our servitude, is seen in our aversion to long expanses of empty time. The true slave is made to fear freedom. Thus we fill up our empty moments with pastimes. We seek to be entertained, that is, to be taken away from ourselves. The underlying anxiety of modern life has robbed us of our moments and bound us to ceaseless doing. The measurement of time, especially its linear measurement, has among its consequences the concept of an abstract future, another fundamental source of anxiety and insecurity. There is always something to prepare for, always a reason to be incompletely immersed in the now. When we mortgage the present to the future, it is usually in the interests of the same practicality we invoke when we cannot afford to. Compare our survival anxiety to Marshall Salen's description of hunter-gatherers. Quote, "A more serious issue is presented by the frequent and exasperated observation of a certain lack of foresight among hunters and gatherers. Oriented forever in the present, without the slightest thought of or care for what the morrow may bring, the hunter seems unwilling to husband supplies, incapable of a planned response to the doom surely awaiting him. Instead, he adopts a studied unconcern." Close quote. In Salen's original affluent society, where nature provides everything in easy abundance, there is no need to plan for the future. In an agricultural society, though, such nonchalance can be fatal. So it gave way to the time-bound mentality of sowing and reaping that still governs the modern mind. Always, we can be doing something to enhance our rational self-interest, to improve our position in the world, to increase our future security. These things are never okay, just as they are when life is at root a struggle for survival. Thus the present becomes slave to the future. That is the defining mentality of agriculture. In the eternal present, would work ever supersede play? A similar phenomenon obtains at the collective level. Without the abstractions of future and past, there would be no such thing as progress. Conversely, without a concept of progress, there is little use for time. The accumulation of culture and technology defines an arrow of time by reference to simpler days. Early on in this exponential ascent, when change was slow, only the most rudimentary consciousness of time existed. As change built upon itself, the awareness of time crystallized as well. Time was not an invention that could have been refused had we only been wiser. Rather, it was an inevitable product of the progression of language, number, and technology, each of which built upon itself and others. Written language, for example, which was originally used for record keeping, allowed the linear binding of time and the conception of history, as words were no longer confined to a moment. Because it is inextricably tied up with speed, convenience, efficiency, progress, technology as we know it is rooted in reified linear time. This invites the question as to whether any other conception of technology is possible. It is difficult to imagine. It would seem that any technology which builds upon itself thereby defines progress and therefore linear time. However, progress need not be unnatural or destructive. Life, after all, has evolved into forms of increasing complexity over 4 billion years, only veering into planetary crisis in the last few thousand. This suggests a different mode of technology, which seeks explicitly to recover and harmonize with nature's patterns. Such technology actually has a precedent in the magical practices of primitive peoples which sought, in John Zerzan's words, quote, "the regularity, not the supersession, of the processes of nature," close quote. Post-technology technology, if I may use such a phrase, will take as its models the cycles of nature, and in particular the magical practices of ancient people. It will seek attunement and not conquest. It will be occupied not with control, but with beauty. This mode of technology, which I will describe later in the book, will not be a separation from nature at all, but an organic extension of nature that will return us to a timeless life in which linear time measurement is but a plaything. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. Images of Images. The separate human realm that grew up around stone and fire, language, number, and time binding, finds explicit reflection in the world of images. Representational art, pictures of things, is quite literally a human-made copy of the world. the world interpreted through human eyes. Extending now far beyond art, the separate realm of images has increasingly taken on a life of its own, diverging from the reality it once represented. The fake images of politicians and corporations, along with our own self-images that we project, are part of a phony world, a realm of appearances. As these appearances diverge more and more from reality, so also grows our intuition of an inauthenticity to life. This section explores the evolution of the world of images that immerses us today. Living in the age of separation, we tend to see and understand art either as a depiction of things, ideas, or emotions mediating human and nature, or as an appendage to life offering aesthetic pleasure, representation, or decoration. But could images serve another purpose? Representational paintings and sculpture are quite new on the face of the earth. Neanderthals did not make them, though they apparently did adopt the use of pigments, possibly by diffusion from modern humans. The earliest known representational paintings were found in a Namibian cave dating back some 59,000 years, followed by an abundance of paintings throughout Africa, Europe, and Australia, starting around 30,000 years ago. Most of them depict animals and are conventionally interpreted as attempts to bring luck to the hunt through sympathetic magic. Similarly, magical or ritual uses are ascribed to the earliest sculptures, which also date to this period and which appear to be fertility symbols. In other words, scholars explain Paleolithic art as an attempt to affect the real world by manipulating its representation. It was a bumbling attempt, though, the kind of magic we have replaced with technology that actually works. Ha ha, those poor primitives actually thought pictures on a wall would actually influence the events those pictures depicted. Consider, however, that this interpretation is yet another projection, a projection of our own anxiety and separation onto primitive artists. Perhaps it is we, not they, who manipulate a matrix of appearances under the delusion that it is the real thing. We should be more cautious in our blithe assumption that hunter-gatherer art was representational in the sense we understand it. That a picture of an animal is separate and distinct from the real animal seems obvious to us, but not to the primitive mind. As Joseph Epps Brown observes, symbols in traditional Native American art, instead of simply pointing to what they represent, actually become what they represent. From the modern perspective, we tend to wink patronizingly at such superstitious primitivism. Those poor fools who actually thought their paintings would bring luck to the hunt, and for that matter, at all the rituals of every, quote, primitive society that has ever existed on Earth. As if we were past all that now, as if technology has replaced the illusory control of nature that subsists in ritual with real control. But consider for a moment, if every human culture up until recent times believed in the power of magic ritual, is it not conceivable that there was something to it? This belief was universal among pre-agricultural peoples. Perhaps it is we moderns who have forgotten the truth and lost touch with basic principles of the universe that every other culture knew. In any event, ostensibly, representational art need not indicate a dualistic mindset. More likely, the dualism grew over time as other developments contributed to a great forgetting of the original magical significance of art. Significantly, as technology and agriculture furthered the distance between human beings and nature, the depictions of artists became more and more stylized, standardized, and abstract, losing the vibrant aliveness of the Lascaux and Chauvet cave paintings, which seemed somehow to capture the spirit of the animals depicted. Compare these to the well-known stylized figures of the agricultural society of ancient Egypt. It is as if the further the artist is removed from nature, the less able she or he is to be a direct channel for the infinity of the real world that somehow impregnates the truly great works of art, and the more necessary it is to control and confine the wild through its representation. As John Zerzan puts it, art turns the subject into an object, confining the infinity of the real world within the conceptual and perceptual framework of a human artist. There remains the possibility, even for a modern artist, to achieve a momentary freedom from culture and domestication, but this requires tapping into our own inner infinity, the spontaneous, undomesticated spirit that lies deeply buried under the vast weight of culture. Such art is described in the Gurdjieff tradition as objective art, not because it reifies representational forms, but precisely because, like Paleolithic images, its primary existence is not representation, but rather a thing in and of itself, that is, it is real. Such art has genuine power. Its presence moves us and can indeed change the world. As human beings turn from the original religion toward the dualistic religions of agriculture, the magical import of art transformed from an inherency in the object itself to an inherency in its representational power. Whereas pre-alienation peoples, animists, believed that the entire universe, animate and inanimate, is living spirit manifest, as separation grew, human beings separated spirit from matter and conceived for the first time that some things might be more spiritual than others. Images and, by extension, rituals became, as John Ralston Saul puts it, a magic trap. Its power no longer resided in what it was, a unique convergence of everything else in the universe, but in what it symbolized, in the spirit it contained. In parallel with the concurrent conception of a soul inhabiting, but separate from, a non-spiritual body, was the magical item became a vessel, not magical in and of itself. It became magical only because of what was invested in it. This stands in contrast to anything that has a power in and of itself, not related to a dualistically conceived content, separate from form. The parallel with the non-semantic meanings of the sounds of the lingua adamica is exact. Shaker furniture is an example of this kind of objective art. Separate neither from form nor function, it lies in the perfection of both. As the magical power of art came to be understood in terms of its representational content, then it stands to reason that artists would pursue perfection in their images, which, according to this belief, would be tantamount to perfect control over the world. Yet when Raphael, Michelangelo, and Leonardo da Vinci made the final technical breakthroughs in perspective around the year 1500, nothing magical happened. Saul writes, "In the West, the painter's and sculptor's job has been to design the perfect trap for human immortality. The ambition was to make representation real, the same ambition that lives on in the latest version of the trap for immortality, the software simulation of consciousness in a VR world. We now live almost wholly in a manufactured reality, a world of images, but really nothing has changed. Using finite methods to approximate the infinite, using representation to approximate reality, we succeed only in building a taller tower. Can it ever reach the sky?" The solution of the puzzle of perspective was not just a technical breakthrough, but a conceptual shift as well. Perspective freezes objects in time by assuming a single viewpoint at a single moment. Before the 14th century, there was no attempt at perspective, because the painter attempted to record things as they are, not as they look. Perspective painting records objects as they look at a given moment of time, and thereby implicitly subordinating reality to the human observer and affirming the fundamental dualism of self and the world. Here is a separate I am of Descartes, a discrete point of perception gazing out upon the other. Perhaps the medieval painters were not awaiting a mere technical breakthrough as the end result of successive advances, but were simply not interested in even attempting perspective at a time when the modern conception of self had not fully matured and when measured time had not fully supplanted rhythms of nature. There is an element of hubris in the capturing of reality that is the perfect image. Perhaps this explains the deep suspicions many religious traditions have of images of the divine, or even of animals, humans, and objects. Judaism and Islam do without them altogether, as did Buddhism until Alexander the Great brought Greek culture, with its obsession with mortality, and not coincidentally with images, to India. There are also many cultures that resist having their photographs taken, intuiting perhaps the hubris and futility of the pseudo-immortality it suggests, or the Faustian exchange of a moment of time which is real for a frozen representation of a moment which is not. Indeed, I have noticed that cameras, and even worse, videotaping, tend to detract from the happy events they are supposed to preserve on film. Taking photographs at birthday parties and weddings to preserve those happy memories substitutes an image for an experience, and we can sometimes imbue the event with a staged feel as if it were not real, as if it were an enactment to be enjoyed later. It is as if we are uncomfortable with real moments and prefer to experience them from a distance, secondhand. In the most extreme case, the photographic or video recording of the event comes to completely define the event itself. Certainly the case in the realm of public relations and politics. A small, but for some people significant way to reduce the alienation of modern life is to put down the camera and participate fully in the moment, rather than trying futilely to preserve the moment on film. The compulsion to record everything bespeaks the underlying anxiety of modern life, the conviction stemming from measured time that our lives are slipping away from us day by day, hour by hour, moment by moment. Perhaps if I photograph them, those precious moments of my children's childhood will always be there, preserved for eternity. I have noticed, though, that when I look at my son's baby pictures, my main emotion is wistfulness, a regret that I did not truly and fully appreciate those precious, unique times. I can seldom look at my most treasured photographs without feeling sadness and regret. The very effort to possess and preserve those moments diminishes them, just as technology in general leaves us alienated from and more afraid of the very world it attempts to control. It is much better to enjoy each beautiful moment in the serene knowledge that an infinity of equally yet differently beautiful moments await. At the same time, the awareness of each moment's transience helps us appreciate it all the more, if we don't succumb to the illusion, offered, for example, by photography, that it can be made permanent. That illusion robs life of its urgency and intensity, substituting for it an insipid complacency that conceals our buried, unmet hunger for real experience. And that unmet hunger, in turn, fuels an endless appetite for the vicarious imitation experiences to be found in television, movies, amusement parks, spectator sports, and the last gasp, reality TV. Buddhism, and I could argue the esoteric teachings of all religions, recognizes the suffering implicit in the attempt to make permanent that which is intrinsically impermanent. The beautiful sand paintings made by Tibetan monks and Navajo Indians, which by the nature of their medium last a very short time, even when they aren't purposefully destroyed the next day, demonstrate an important principle. The value of beauty does not depend on its preservation. The modern mind tends to think of their creation as a waste of time, creating something beautiful only to destroy it again, and wants to preserve it in a museum, derive some benefit from it. This way of thinking, in which we mortgage the present moment for future moments, is precisely the mentality of agriculture, in which we must sow in order to reap, in which the future motivates and justifies the labor of the present. When we photograph, record, and archive the present, we are driven by the same anxiety as the agriculturalist who knows that unless he stores up grain now, there will be scarcity in the future. Just as the agriculturalist no longer trusts, as hunter-gatherers do, in providence, the easy bounty of nature, so also are we compelled to save up beautiful moments as if their supply were limited. When nothing magical happened, when the painted image was perfected, it did not take long for disappointment and eventually desperation to infect the world of art. Saul writes, "For some 20 years after Raphael's discovery, craftsmen celebrated their triumph with an outpouring of genius. But gradually the subconscious failure beneath this conscious success began to slow them and to darken their perspective. The viewer has only to watch Titian's opulence and sensuous joy gradually turn tragic. With no room left for progress, the image turned and dodged and circled back and buried itself like an animal chained to its own impossible promise, searching for some way to get beyond the mortality of the real. But try as it might, through all the contortions of the successive waves of artistic movements, from Impressionism's demonstration of the facticity of the image to Cubism's shattering of perspective, the image cannot escape from the reality that it is nothing more than paint on canvas. Further perfections of the image only reinforce the disappointment. Photography, then motion pictures, then holography, similarly fail to produce magical results, that is, actual control of reality via control over its representation. Yet, unwilling to admit defeat, we press on with virtual reality, a fitting metaphor for the dead end to which our separation of self has brought us. The separate human realm that originated with the circle of the campfire is nearly complete now, a wholly artificial reality. We have arrived only to find ourselves feeling more lost than ever before. The second-hand pseudo-experiences that today's entertainment media provide assuage our hunger for real experience temporarily, but in the end only intensify that hunger. Like any object of addiction, they are a counterfeit that leaves the real need unmet, a shortcoming that is temporarily disguisable by increasing the dose. Movies and music, for example, have become progressively more intense, louder, and faster paced over recent decades. Computer 3D animation has brought to fruition the painter's old dream of the perfect image, even a moving image. Yet the inconvenient fact remains that however perfect, the image can never be real, and the virtual world can never be a real world. And this phenomenon is not limited to the entertainment media. John Zerzan writes, quote, "Everyone can feel the nothingness, the void, just beneath the surface of everyday routines and securities," close quote. We live in a world of images, of representations, that separate us from real experience. We then try to meet the hunger for reality with yet more images. The further intensification of dosage is therefore an inevitability. We can never get enough. It is like trying to assuage hunger by chewing gum. The 2004 presidential campaign offers an example of just how far we have become lost in a world of images disconnected from reality. In the words of journalist Matt Taibbi, the whole thing could easily be done in a movie studio. It is a world in which nothing is real and everything is staged, in which every action is calculated and every encounter scripted according to how it will look. The inauthenticity is palpable, as candidates everywhere obsess about their image. Speaking of the Kerry campaign, Taibbi explains, "All they want to do is hit those dial survey words they know are going to impress voters. Change, leadership, strength. These are literally infantile concepts that they want to communicate to you, close quote. The delusion that image trumps reality has even extended to U.S. official policy in the infamous Brand America campaign to improve America's image in the Middle East. The world of images of which I speak is not limited to corporate identity systems and the posturings of politicians. Even on an individual level, we tend to be obsessed with appearances, with projecting an acceptable image of ourselves to the world. I'm not just talking about the superficialities of fashion, but of the subtle masks and poses we wear as shields in a world filled with strangers. The unreality of the modern world projects onto our faces, into our voices, into our thoughts, hence the mounting desire to get real in search of authenticity. Just as words are losing their meaning, so also have images lost their power and mystique. Leibniz and other thinkers in the Age of Reason believed in the possibility of inventing a perfect language so congruent to reality that no false utterances would even be possible, not realizing the object of their search existed prior to language and could never be reached by increased precision of representation, but only by transcending representation altogether. No language has ever before had the number of words that exist in English, the profusion of precise technical terms for increasingly fine divisions of reality. Yet true meaning recedes all the further. In the same way, images of reality proliferate toward ubiquity to the point where the latest cellular phones have digital cameras built in, and video cameras record our every movement in public space, but they don't seem to mean anything anymore. The most graphic cinematic images of violence leave us unmoved, because we know that despite their near-perfect verisimilitude, they are not real. Nothing is in a world of images. What power images still bear is rapidly fading as it becomes easier and easier to manufacture perfect images unconnected to reality. Shortly before the Abu Ghraib prison abuse scandal, a photograph circulated of a smiling GI and an Iraqi boy next to him cheerfully holding up a sign that said, "This man raped my mother and killed my father." The sick joke was that the boy didn't understand English and was unwittingly humiliating himself. But then other versions of the photo circulated with a different message on the sign, and it was impossible to tell which was authentic. Yet even when their authenticity is not in question, somehow photographs are losing their power to shock, as the muted American response to the Abu Ghraib images testifies. Where is the outrage, the disgust, the national shame? Perhaps because of the increasing ubiquity of depictions of graphic violence and diabolical cruelty in the entertainment media, we have seemingly become inured to violent or tragic images even when they are not fictitious. We treat them as just so many pixels. Doesn't life go on as usual anyway? A further symptom and consequence of the divorce between reality and image is the gradual migration of art to the position of irrelevance that the dualistic distinction between art and craft implies. Art is concerned with aesthetics, craft with function. In medieval times, painters were considered to be craftsmen performing a useful social, political, and religious function. And it was not until the 18th century that a distinction between the fine arts and useful arts was conceived. As Saul Riley observes, put another way, by the 18th century, society was beginning consciously to doubt that art was useful. By the next century, the first museums for purely aesthetic purposes were established. The aesthetic function of art, today accepted almost universally, virtually consigns it to irrelevance, a pretty flourish divorced from function. As Zurzan puts it, quote, "Kierkegaard found the defining trait of the aesthetic outlook to be its hospitable reconciliation of all points of view and its evasion of choice. This can be seen in the perpetual compromise that at once valorizes art, only to repudiate its intent and contents with, "Well, after all, it is only art," close quote. Maybe this is why I, along with all little children, detest art museums. Ordinarily, I can walk 10 miles without undue discomfort. But after about 20 minutes in a museum, my feet get tired and I start whining for someone to buy me an ice cream cone. Museums reaffirm that art is just for looking at, don't touch, even as their walls and glass cases physically separate it from the rest of the world. Despite their great efforts to preserve art, which ought to validate its importance, by their very nature, museums affirm art's irrelevancy and separateness. Going back a little further, we can call into question the distinction, not just between art and craft, but between art and life as well. According to Joseph Epps Brown, Native American languages have no term for art at all. He quotes James Houston as follows, quote, "I believe Eskimos do not have a satisfactory word for art because they have never felt the need for such a term. Like most other hunting societies, they have thought of the whole act of living in harmony with nature as their art," close quote. Later he writes, "To dismiss utilitarian items only as crafts in this way has contributed to the tragic separation of art from life. Within created traditional Native American forms, however, there can be no such dichotomy, because art is not only the particular created form, but also the inner principle from which the outer form comes into being. An art form is often seen as beautiful, not just in terms of aesthetics, but also because of its usefulness and the degree to which it serves its purpose." By the foregoing critique of art, I do not mean to advocate the excision of art from life, but rather the merger of these two categories. Art can be a way of life that encompasses all its dimensions. As Wendell Berry puts it, quote, "The possibility of an entirely secular art and of works of art that are spiritless or ugly or useless is not a possibility that has been among us for very long. Traditionally, the arts have been ways of making that have placed a just value on their materials or subjects, on the uses and the users of the things made by art, and on the artists themselves. They have, that is, been ways of giving honor to the works of God. There is not a material or subject in creation that in using we are excused from using well. There is no work in which we are excused from being able and responsible artists," close quote. Such honoring of creation, that is, the world, is utterly inconsistent with the logic of modern biology and economics. Why do anything better than it needs to be done? The dictates of biological survival and reproduction, or of economic competition, reward a certain level of excellence, but nothing beyond that. Nothing motivated internally by the worker and her materials, but only externally by the environment or the marketplace. Good enough, in other words, is good enough. I see the results of this all the time in education, in which learning is motivated by the grade. Why learn more than what is necessary for the A? Under the logic of the discrete and separate self, any reason to do more than good enough is always an illusion. Our very worldview has sundered art from life, rendering the former by definition frivolous or irrelevant, and the latter a dispirited caricature of itself, an empty shell. And the reuniting of these two categories, art and life, is central to the healing that will occur with the collapse of the age of separation. Yes! And I have been reading from The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and The Convergence of Crises That is Birthing the Transition by Charles Eisenstein. And I will continue next week, but if you can't bear to wait, you may find it and other interesting material on the work of this amazing thinker at ascentofhumanity.com. Music in today's program was Nahatsan by Sharon Birch, and our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.